At the very end of 2016, 193 crosses appeared outside the Leawood Baptist Church. Each cross represents a human life lost to homicide in the past year in the metro. The staggering visual, which caused traffic to slow down and even inspired some cars to honk, was part of a memorial service for victims' families called The Longest Night, which fittingly took place on the winter solstice. Yesterday, as the display came down, some families came to pick up their loved ones' crosses. Pastor Adam Carter read the victims' names.
Anthony Bell, DeAdrian Bell, Danny R. Beverly, Mark Bivens, Jared M. Blake, Cherie Bland, Robert A. Blaylock, Charles Bolton, Charles Bradford, Miranda Bradford, Rocky Bradley, Jacob Brantner, Brene Brown, Gerald Brown, Tyra Brown, Clarence Buford, Joshua Bush, Michael L.
The number of crosses the pastor displays has gone up every year for all of the 5 years he's done this. In 2016, Kansas City's homicide rate was the highest it had been in almost a decade. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And as much as we may want to believe that a new year is a clean slate, putting a new calendar on the wall probably is not going to solve this problem. So what is going on? Let's chip away at that question. We'll start by talking to Jackson County Prosecutor Jean Peters Baker. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
How significant was the uptick in homicides this year from your perspective?
Very significant. I know my office, we measure our community's success, our failures, based in part on that number. So it was a significant, significant number to us.
What is the increase about? I mean, I know there isn't an easy answer to that, but in your position, you must at least have some thoughts.
Yeah, I have some thoughts. You are more correct, though, when you say that there are no simple answers. Those who bring you simple answers, you should be suspect of. This is a complicated problem. It's a historic problem, not just one decade, but multiple decades.
What do you mean it's a historic problem, though? A history of what?
Kansas City has a history of violence, and the type of violence we saw in 2016 is not unknown to Kansas City's history. Not in the least. We have seen that kind of violence for decades.
So, though, when you look at the past 8 years, which is kind of what we're talking about, why is the sloping down and the coming back up, is that just a blip on the radar, or is there a story to that?
I think there is a story to that. In 2014, very late in 2014, a new town got put on the map for America, and that town was called Ferguson. And we all have been impacted by Ferguson in ways that I think many of us could never have fully predicted we would be impacted
by that town. Explain what you mean by that. I mean, we're in Kansas City. We're not super far from Ferguson, but what does Kansas City seeing higher homicide rates in 2016 have to do with what happened in Ferguson in 2014?
I think homicide rates can often be linked to the legitimacy that community and police have with one another. And when legitimacy is in question and when it is in high debate, you will have higher rates of violence. There is absolutely every statistic will point to that as being true. That is part of what happened from this little town called Ferguson, that the rest of the world, the rest of the nation, began to question, do we believe in the legitimacy of our police departments? And you and I may have that debate one way. We may hear a debate about police legitimacy in one way, but certain members of the community will hear it far differently. Those who already distrust police, those who it's not uncommon for them to pick up a gun to solve their disputes, they hear that debate quite differently than you and I.
So this is partly about not believing that there is an orderly resolution to conflict?
Yes, I think that's true. I also think that the ready availability of guns in this city, among other cities across the nation, is also part of the uptick. And you cannot look at that homicide rate of 2016 and not also look at, well, how many of those homicides were committed by what means? What was the tool?
Yeah, what's the answer to that question?
90% of those homicides were committed by a gun. So, you know, if you don't want to look at those numbers and actually honor those numbers, then, you know, you're forgetting it. There's one solution in there, or there's one problem in there that we all should address.
How are you seeing different people responding to this? I mean, whether we're talking about organizations that exist in our communities to combat violence, or whether we're talking about law enforcement itself, even just victims, families, friends, how are people responding?
So I think, you know, we've traveled some road since 2014 in this debate about, you know, police use of force and how we perceive police. And those of us who have been in this business for some time know that this is just a road that we've had to travel. It's a road that we've had to walk. We have tried very hard in Kansas City to travel that road together. And I really have to underscore the quality of the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. When other cities were literally lit on fire because of this debate, Kansas City Police Department arranged buses for protesters and handed out bottles of water. And that makes a difference. So though our homicide rate is unacceptably high, we also have a police department that really tries to reach out to community and show them their heart and soul.
And I want to get back to the Kansas City Police Department shortly, but we're going to be focusing on the particular problem of children falling victim to violence and homicide in our communities. You spend time with victims' families, right?
Yes, quite a bit.
Can you describe what happens after, I mean, it's unimaginably horrible, but after a child is the victim of one of these crimes?
There's probably nothing worse than when a child is struck by any violence, certainly gun violence that takes a child's life. It's really devastating for not just the individual family, because that's a repair that cannot, there's no repairing that loss, but it's a damage to community as a whole.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, part of my soul gets chipped away when a child gets struck by gun violence. And I know that's true about my entire community. And when I say my community, I mean my metro-wide community. This is not just, I'm not talking about just certain blocks of Kansas City. I'm talking about Overland Park and Blue Springs and everyone else in the surrounding area. It chips away at all of us.
But chips away in what way?
I think it is very, very damaging when children, the innocence of a child is taken in the, you know, that's added to our numbers. All homicides are important to me, and that we solve every one of them and that we try and achieve justice for everyone is critically important. It's more important, however, that we can focus on prevention. How can we find a way to make those numbers fewer so that there are fewer families reeling from that kind of damage, and that our community is also less impacted by that kind of damage as well.
You sent out a tweet in November that I'd like to read. Another child shot, infuriating. Some problems are complex, but not this one. Kids can be safe with simple and inexpensive gun safety measures. I want to pull that into two pieces. I mean, first of all, the idea that this is not a complex problem. What is it that's simple about this?
What I was referring to in that tweet was a child who was accidentally shot by a gun that was left out. Look, that is a simple problem that everyone today could solve. If you are a gun owner and you have children that come in and out of your home at all, you have a responsibility and you better take it. You better take it, because no matter what I might be able to do, you know, in that kind of circumstance from a criminal charge perspective, no one can prepare someone for the guilt they must carry for the rest of their life. that a child was killed by their own negligence, by a gun that they left out, that they didn't properly secure. This is a solvable problem. Secure your weapons. That is your responsibility.
You know, there is so much passion in your voice, and it's hard for me to imagine doing what you do with this sort of, like, rawness that I feel like you're bringing to this without how, I mean, it seems like desensitizing yourself would be useful in some ways. I mean, yeah, how do you bear to do what you do?
I look at it as a privilege and an honor to do this. It is an opportunity that I know will be probably short-lived. And so I want to do the very, very best job I know how to do. And championing kids, man, that's easy.
Well, whose job is it, when you get right down to it, to keep children safe? Because none of the platitudes people sometimes throw around to dismiss grown-up safety as kind of that grown-up's own problem or responsibility could even conceivably apply to kids. I mean, they can't protect themselves.
Absolutely. It is we as a community and as individuals should never shift the responsibility of a child's safety to a child. We are a better society than that. We are a better community than that. And so it is our jobs, our collective jobs, to make sure that children are safe.
Well, how do I, as a citizen, do that job? You know what I mean?
There's several ways you do that job. One way is take seriously your responsibility as a community member. Take seriously your responsibility to call the child abuse hotline and report suspected abuse of kids. And if you think that does not have an impact, then just try and remember, very recently in Kansas City's history, there was a little girl who someone called, an anonymous caller called that hotline and literally saved this little girl's life. She was in a horrible situation in her home. She was nearly starved to death by her mother. And that anonymous caller saved her life
by
making a call.
What had that caller observed that allowed them to kind of put two and two together well enough to make that call?
So that caller did not know for certain. That caller did not know for certain that this little girl were in harm's way. She believed the little girl was missing. And there was some stories about where the little girl was, that, oh, she was with her father. She was with another family member. And things didn't quite add up for the caller. So she simply contacted the hotline and reported what she did know, which led police to that apartment. And I will tell you, it still chills me to think about that story and to hear the accounting of that police officer who said, we were about to leave when we shouted out up a set of stairs, is anyone here? And a little voice behind a closet door said, I am.
Oh my gosh. I mean, you bring up the issue of domestic abuse and things that happen inside homes, private homes that put children in harm's way. And I'm curious, first of all, how big a part of the problem of violence that children suffer from, I mean, how big a part of that is domestic abuse?
Look, I think it's a huge part. I think children who grow up in homes where violence is part of what they see pretty regularly, I think children who have to witness often their mothers being abused by their partners inside their home is incredibly dramatic and impactful to a child. And I think that shows up later in life. There's no doubt about it.
How many of the, what kind of like percentage of the violent crimes committed against children result in death? I mean, how many of those are in the home?
I'm sorry, how many? I didn't understand your question. Sorry.
Of all, I mean, when we look at this homicide rate and know that some of those victims are children, mm-hmm. is that a significant percentage of those, the what happens in homes, private homes?
Look, there were seven children in 2016 that were struck by gun violence and their lives taken. There were others who were struck and thank God, lived through that ordeal. So that number doesn't fully, I think, give the full impact. There's a lot of children that experience violence inside the home that we never know about. It's never reported. We don't get to know. So it's really hard to kind of put a statistic on things that we have to wait for there to be, real harm to have happened before police come out and respond. I think as a community, we need to do far more than that. We need to be intervening before the 911 call.
The Kansas City Star reported on some serious issues within the Kansas City Police Department's Crimes Against Children Department. Briefly, what can you tell us about that?
Well, look, what I can tell you about that is that the Crimes Against Children's Unit within the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department has dramatically changed. They have dramatically improved their processes. And I know that from working with them, but I know it from this number. 176 Crimes Against Children's cases were filed from that unit during the year of 2016. The year before, only 62. Cases were filed. So that should tell you.
What does that tell us, though? I mean, I guess for all of our listeners, I mean, what is the significance of those things being filed?
When a case is filed, it means that we have enough evidence to proceed, that we have a complete investigation, and it doesn't guarantee we're going to go in a courtroom and win, but it does mean we believe we have a case, that we have a fighting chance to go into a courtroom and get justice for that child. That's what it means. We have more than doubled the number of cases that in 2016 that I believed we could get into that courtroom and get justice for those kids. And that means abusers are held accountable for their bad acts. So for us, that's a huge win.
So you think there's improvement?
I know there's improvement. I know that.
What are you doing as prosecutor to address the safety of our city's children and to work to keep them from harm moving forward?
This is really difficult. But one of the things that I continue to press is all of our responsibility to be reporters of child abuse and neglect. Some of us are mandated reporters. If you're a teacher or a nurse, a doctor, a priest, if you're a prosecutor, we're mandated reporters. We must report what we know. But all of us should deem ourselves mandated reporters. If you see a child in harm's way or you suspect a child is being injured and you don't do anything, then you should consider yourself one of those child's abusers. That's the way I see it. So there's so much we can do if we intervene in a child's life. If we can prevent future harm from coming to them, we've just made a huge impact on community.
It's so complicated, and I don't want to get too hung up on this, but, you're witnessing a scene like in a grocery store. You don't know these people. You don't know their names. You don't know where they live. How do you intervene?
Yeah, I think if you are witnessing a child being abused in front of you in a store, I think, you have to call the police and get police there. If you have enough interaction with a family because you're a neighbor or you're maybe a distant family member and you are seeing what you believe is abuse, you can call and report anonymously. You do not have to give your name and your address. You can if you wish, but it is not required. So you can actually make an anonymous call and be protected.
I want to get Rosalind Temple in on this conversation. Rosalind is the director of the Kansas City chapter of Mothers in Charge. That's an organization of mothers who have lost children to homicide. And Rosalind has had the unfortunate experience of losing her son. Rosalind, we've talked before, and I've told you I'm sorry before, but I don't think I could say it too many times. I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
You regularly meet mothers who, like yourself, have lost children to homicide, and you show up to every scene after a homicide to bridge the gap between communities and law enforcement. How does that perspective shape the way you hear what our county prosecutor is telling us?
It all adds up because what she's saying is true. I truly believe after Ferguson, it became unrest around a lot of cities. And I seen the unrest here in Kansas City. And could have been just a drop of a dime that a bad situation could occur. But we have a good Kansas City Police Department. And like our prosecutor, like Jean Peter Baker said, how they arrange buses and hand out water to the protesters. We didn't feed into it. And see, we have a community that we are bridging the gap. We are coming together to make a difference, to say that we want to save lives. We don't want to keep on having lives taken.
So you see Kansas City as having had success in that area, but then we have had this increase in violence in 2016.
Yes, I have. 2016 really, it bothered me. It really bothered me in the sense of, I said, I wasn't in fear, but it was scary because it was happening so fast before you can even breathe. I'm quite sure before the prosecutors even can look at one case, they was having another case just exactly like the homicide detectives. So for me, going on them scenes, it was just happening so fast, and revisiting this scene I once had to revisit, and revisiting families that have lost their loved ones, and like children, that was just unbelievable for a community, for us to allow something to happen like that.
Whose job do you think it is to keep children safe?
I think it's a community. It's definitely our responsibility, and I think it starts in our homes. It starts with families. You know, we see things. We can tell when things are not right in a household. Even as a neighbor, community, you see children where they're not properly being taken care of. So it's us as a community and as families to speak up and help them children.
So you think? Do you think that it's mostly what happens in households that puts children at safety, not out on the street, caught in crossfire, nothing like that? Just that the biggest problem really is what happens in a home?
Exactly. Yes, it's people that you are connected to. It's in your homes. I believe it's learned behavior. It is learned behavior.
This explain
homicide,
what you mean by that.
Violence is like our prosecutor said. You know, when children see their mother being abused, a lot of dysfunction, drugs, in and out, no rest, people coming in and out the house all times of night, different drug transactions. Children are very smart. They're curious. You know, I remember I was a child. You're curious, so you see things, so you look and you watch, and when your parents and you think your child is not watching, they are. So that's what I mean by learned behavior. You see things like that, and you think, oh, well, it worked for my parents. It looked pretty good, and so it worked for me. We grew up as a child, as an adult, I'm sorry, and then there we go.
Some people might say it's a parent's job to keep kids safe. What would you tell them about why that can maybe be easier said than done under some circumstances?
Well, it is a parent's job to keep our children safe. You know, sometimes we have to make decisions what is best for that child. You know, if we have an issue, a drug issue, we having problems of keeping lights, water, gas on, even paying our bills, reach out for help. Maybe you have to give the child over to a sister or aunt for temporary custody. It's not about you. It's about that child, what best fits that child. And then it comes back to a community. If you see where a child is hungry, maybe before the hotline even occur, reach out to that parent and say, how can I help you? Is there any way I can direct you to some kind of resources to be able to help your children, even be able to improve your life? But if that doesn't work, then you take the next step. Then you do the hotline. See, we have to come out of being scared of what they're going to think about us or what they're going to say about us. It's all about that child.
So, I guess I often can think of parents as victims just right alongside their children, even when it's the children whose life has been taken. I mean, you see a pretty clear responsibility on the parent's part, it sounds like.
Yes, I do. I know that a parent has issues. See, and it goes back to that parent. I don't know what their childhood was about. I don't know. But I just truly believe sometimes a parent can give something that they don't have. And that's love. If you never really had true love and been shown love and been nurtured, you can't give what you don't have. So I do a lot of situations. Some parents I do look at and feel sorry for and say, you know, she didn't have that to give. But where was the responsibility of someone else around that family? Seeing that parent didn't have that ability to be that parent, to step in and say, hey, I want to help. If not, I can't give you help directly, I would choose to hotline you. Because I see children getting cussed out. That is not something that you just get cursed out by your parents. That is not no way you talk to your child.
Jean Peters Baker, Jackson County prosecutor, what's your perspective on that?
Roslyn is a great partner for this community. I'm so grateful to have her representing Mothers in Charge. And she gives me a confidence when I go to a crime scene to know she's there giving comfort and aid to a family who is in such desperate need. So I will say Kansas City is very, very lucky to have her.
But what about what she's telling us right now about whose job it is and the role of the parent in keeping kids safe?
Of course, it's the parent's job first, always and always. But that doesn't mean community does not also have a role. Of course, parents have a role, and of course, they are to be held accountable. But community can be there to assist and help them.
Jean Peters Baker, thanks for joining us this morning. And Rosalind Temple of Mothers in Charge will be staying with us past the break to talk about keeping kids safe from violent crime. Do you feel like kids are safe where you live? And if not, how does that affect your behavior, your decisions, your emotional well-being? Call us up, 816-235-2888. KCUR Central Standard will be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to KCUR Central Standard. Coming out of a year with the highest homicide rate in almost a decade, we want to know how we as a community can keep kids in particular safe. We've been talking with Rosalind Temple of Mothers in Charge, an organization of moms who have lost children to violence. Hi again, Rosalind.
Hi.
We have a couple of other guests with us who I'd like to introduce now. Toya Like is here from UMKC's Department of Criminology. Hi, Toya.
Hi.
And we've also got Courtney Carr with us. She's a therapist who specializes in the trauma surrounding homicide. Thanks for being here, Courtney.
Thank you for having me.
You can call 816-235-2888 to join our conversation about the safety of children in Kansas City's communities. Do you feel like kids are safe where you live? And if not, how does that affect your day-to-day decisions and your overall sense of well-being? 816-235-2888. Rosalind, I want you to take us into the reality of the work you do. In August, you were called to a scene in the middle of the night near 58th and College. Three children were caught in the line of fire when gunshots were fired into their home, and two of those children, two young boys, were killed in the incident. Tell us that story from your perspective, what you encountered when you showed up there.
For instance, that crime scene was right around the corner from my house, and I couldn't believe it. So close, but I get there and see these parents out screaming, crying, police department doing what they do, the investigation, just in an array, and hearing that two children, young boys, have been shot and maybe has been killed. Take the parents and run back and forth trying to comfort each one of them. Even the fathers is there, you know, the mothers, their sisters, trying to, you know, just to guide them the best way I can, making sure they have Kleenex, and trying to talk to the police department, the homicide detective, to see what I can do, even help them farther, which way to go. Getting the parents, come to find out one of the parents was my cousin. Getting him to the hospital, taking him down to Children's Mercy Hospital, where his son was, to be with his family, his wife, and everybody. That was just, it was back and forth. So I was back out there on 57, just back and forth, just driving around, but trying to help these mothers and these fathers just screaming and hurting. And it took me back to where I was.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, you told one of our reporters that we are failing our children. When you say we, who do you mean?
I mean we as a community. I definitely believe we as a community, because to this day, right today, their homicide is still unsolved. How have we allowed these people to roam our streets some more? And they have took two innocent children's life. These are young boys. They were cousins in their home where they're supposed to be. Well, they should have felt safe. And you come and shoot up the house the way you did. We as a community have failed them, because we know, we have to, someone know who pulled them triggers, who killed them children. So I'm saying they're set in someone's home, these perpetrators. They're still roaming around our schools, our stores, our malls. They even had a Christmas and a New Year. We as a community and people, family members, have failed these children.
How long have you been doing this work?
I went on my first homicide scene in 2012.
The homicide rate in Kansas City, as we've been saying, I mean, it spiked in 2016. How has the last year been different for you? Has it been different?
Yes, it has. 2016 just basically blew my mind. I just, you know, I've been doing this since 2012. Never thought I would see Kansas City go up that high. I know what they said happened years and years before. We always have been, but I was younger and not really paying much attention. But when my son's life was taken in the way it was taken, I stepped into this new life, this new norm for me. And seeing Kansas City doing it since 2012, and here at 2016 with 100 and some, over 120 some homicides, it just blew my mind.
You know, you, I know that you go door to door with mothers who have lost children, talking to people in communities and neighborhoods and trying to make the violence resonate as something that's really personal. Why is that important? Why does that feel like a solution to you?
Because when a person see a mother, and you know, I don't discredit fathers or anything, but just the love of a mother that you have for your child. Then when you birth that child in this world, and then that person, you go door to door and knock on doors when a homicide, when a child has been taken, and you knock on the door with that mother, or we're mother saying, we have experienced this. Could you please help us? Did you see anything? That person just looking in that mother's eyes and just the love for their mother, it just does something. It makes a difference. It really makes a difference.
Toya, you know, when we step back and look at this a little less personally and a little more systematically, do we see things that individual stories miss, or is it important to be really personal about this?
I think it is very, very important to be really personal about this. So even though from a professional standpoint, I study victimization and the things, risk factors, some of the things that you all have been talking about today, and I want to see on a broad scale, what are some of the proximate causes of violent encounters? You know, what role do environmental factors play, community factors, and beyond? But it's something different, you know, as we listen to the intro where you hear the names of actual people who were victims of homicide. And also, I mean, just to be perfectly honest, one of the things that drew me, if I look at my own life, one of the things that drew me to studying victimization as opposed to offending in terms of crime is that my mother was a victim of homicide. And so something that was said earlier on this show, I believe it was Jean was saying this, Jean Peters Baker was saying that it does chip away at us, you know, so even though we work in these things in a very professional sense, the idea that we're still talking about, I can say that, you know, 25% of, you know, individuals were victims of homicide. But when I tell you a person's story and their experience, that these were children who were murdered, that this is what this person's life was like prior to this encounter, this incident, right, that brings a whole different aspect to it. So I do think that as much as important as it is for me as a professional to understand the broad sort of bigger picture, to understand these individuals, that these are human lives, I think is also important.
What does research in your field in criminology tell us about the systematic causes and maybe systematic solutions?
Again, something that was articulated earlier is that we can't detach this from sort of like what we call in our discipline now the Ferguson effect. That Ferguson was an example of what we knew to be happening across communities that were suffering. And it's not just true of, you know, this is Kansas City, Chicago, St. Louis, D.C., is that when you have a community of folks who have little trust in the system, who are structurally blocked out from a system that they have very little faith in terms of helping them to resolve their conflicts, they will use other means to resolve conflict. One thing we know about homicide is that these are typically individuals that are known to each other and they have a conflict and use violence as a way of resolving that conflict. Also, in terms of broader issues systematically, we've got to look at the role of disadvantage, right? That one thing that has been true and has remained true in terms of studies of crime is that we know depressed areas, regardless of the composition of the people living there racially, depressed areas tend to have higher problems. So when underemployment, unemployment, poverty, chronic poverty are issues, then we see violence as a way of resolving conflict. That individuals, you know, are really looking at ways to resolve conflict and I disparity.
When you think about a depressed area or an economic disadvantage, you think about resources is really what you're talking about, and access to resources. Do you think that law enforcement is a resource that people have unequal access to?
I do. And I'll say that because one of the things we have to understand, while Kansas City is, having been able to work with the Kansas City Police Department, with Rosalind Temple and Mothers in Charge and other community-based agencies, Kansas City's Police Department does work really, really hard to connect with the community by relying on KC Mothers in Charge and community advocates to help bridge that gap between them and these communities. One thing we cannot forget is that the disconnect between impoverished communities in law enforcement, and especially African-American communities in law enforcement, is historical, right? That if we were to look at policing in the United States, while it's modeled after the English system, the only thing unique to policing in the United States is the differential policing of people of color and slave patrols. And so this is a longstanding disconnect between the African-American community and law enforcement. And when you don't trust the criminal justice system to help you resolve disputes because of differential access to legitimate means of handling conflict and conflict resolution, you will use alternative means.
Let's talk to Chris in Kansas City, Missouri, who called us at 816-235-2888. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I really have to differ. First of all, it's an excellent panel, and you're talking about the end result of a problem that has its basis, as they have said, within the community. We have several businesses east of Troost, and when we call the police, they either do not come, or when they do come, they treat legitimate people the same as criminals. And we need to go back to neighborhood policing, where you have an officer who walks the streets, walks the blocks, knows the neighborhood, knows the people. If parents need assistance, they'll know to come and help them. That two-year-old girl who was in the closet, a police officer wouldn't notice that she was missing if he was in the neighborhood. If we have the 10th most violent city in the country, how can you possibly say that our police force is working properly? It's beyond imagination you would make those kind of statements. There is a problem with differential policing in those neighborhoods, and we need people on the streets who know the neighborhood and can be a resource for people directly, rather than being treated like a corporate robot when they show up. So I'm just passionately involved with this because we have dealt with this for decades over there, and this state-controlled policing is not working at all, as evidenced by the figures themselves. So I'll calm down and let you all comment.
Irritates me. So, the passion is understandable.
Much.
Thank you, Chris. Rosalind Temple, you work as someone who bridges the gap at crime scenes between law enforcement and communities. Do you agree with what Chris is saying? Do you see nuance in it that we maybe weren't hearing there?
Well, I go back to me being a problem of my community for years. And I didn't want to see the police in my community, on my block. I would come out and say, why are they still on my block? Because I was a problem. I was doing some things that I shouldn't have been doing. So I was trying to protect what I was doing. So what I see, and I always see, I live on the other side of this law, of the law. So what I see when my son was murdered, the police was all I have, and they still who all I have today. They're still working my son case. 2011, here we is in 2017, it is unsolved, and someone knows who killed my son on Thanksgiving Eve, November 23rd, at his own apartment. So I have a problem with that. I do get what he's saying. Neighborhood policing would be great, but I'm saying it still comes back to us as a community. And what I deal with in the metro part, black-on-black homicides, that's what I deal with. It is us. When I go to the crime scene, it is us that is killing each other. We have to direct our anger, our frustration to something better. We have to try to sit down and talk this out and make better choices. Killing someone, it could be a bad choice, but sometimes it's not a bad choice. That you premeditated, you thought about this, you called yourself planning this out, and you took a life. So I get what Chris is saying. I understand what he's saying. But at this point, being a mother, that my child's life was taken and it's still unsolved today, you cannot tell me that no one doesn't know who killed Antonio Thompson. So neighbor policing, yeah, bring it back in. But we have to do our part.
When you talk of, a phrase like black on black, crime. I mean, people out who are not Black might hear that as sort of, I don't know, putting a responsibility on a community within a context of racial inequality, that some people might hear that as maybe unfair.
No, my community understand. We know. We don't feel it's unfair. It's just telling the truth. It's speaking what needs to be said. And see, when I'm called out to every homicide in Kansas City, our metro area, and I go out and I see my people, my families, people. I grew up and lived in Kansas City all my life. I know most of every Kansas City because, like I said, I was sometime on the other side. So when I go out, it's not racial profiling. It's telling the truth. See, sometimes we have to speak the truth. We don't want to speak the truth. And I am going to speak the truth because I see it every day.
I'm hoping we can get back to this, but let's talk quickly with Bev in South Kansas City. Hi, Bev.
Good morning.
What can you share?
Well, in terms of learned behavior and neighborhood support, I'm a senior citizen who loves my neighborhood. And there's some little girls that live across the street. And one day I observed them writing on a piece of concrete over the sewer. And I was asking them, were they using chalk or a marker? Well, the mother came out and blasted me right in front of the kids. And it's not her property. And she's, you know, this and that. And the kids went inside. And for a few days, nobody spoke. And then one day the mom came over to ask to use my phone and became warm and friendly. Well, all I was doing was, A, trying to protect the neighborhood, the look of the neighborhood, and teach the girls you don't write on concrete with markers. And the mother's attitude was so bad, and that's what she modeled for the children. So I just plea for attitudinal change in the community, with the police department or whatever, because if we're going to think children first, then we have to behave in a way that our children will learn to maybe do things differently. But
okay,
bad attitude.
Bev, I'm going to jump in because we're short on time, but Toya, I mean, how can community members protect children when there is kind of a prevalent attitude of stay off of my lawn?
And I think it goes back to neighboring, right? That what Rosalind is sharing is the importance of community, because just like Black on Black crime, we know that Black people are more likely to be murdered by other Blacks, white by whites, Asian by Asian. You know, most people are murdered by people who look like them, who come from where they come from. And so it becomes a community shared responsibility. The passionate caller, Chris, I agree, but we place so much onus on law enforcement to solve community-based problems. These are individuals who are known, individuals in the community who know, but this distrust of police keeps police from being able to intervene and resolve these conflicts.
We have one more break this morning. We're going to bring a therapist who visits some of these scenes in on the conversation when we get back. KCUR Central Standard will return shortly. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, talking about Kansas City's homicide rate and what we as a community can do to protect children from violent crime. My guests are Rosalind Temple of Mothers in Charge, Toya Like, a criminology professor, and a therapist who we're about to hear from, Courtney Carr, with us from the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime and Swope Health Services. Courtney, talk to me about what you are hearing. Are there things that maybe sound simple but are less simple when human psychology enters the picture?
Definitely less simple. We're looking at a lot of different things that create a whole picture. We're looking at generational trauma. We're looking at individual trauma. We're looking at distrust within the law enforcement. We're looking at a culture cultivated within a community where it is, we do not tell our business and we don't snitch.
Okay, elaborate on that one a little bit. I mean, people are familiar with that concept, I think, but that sounds in some ways like an after the incident kind of problem. And it sounds like you're saying that it actually is a cause of the problem.
It's a cause. It is a start. It's everything. We grow up in households where everything that happens stays in this household. It does not leave this household. You do not tell the business. And then that outreaches to the community.
You're saying we.
We, as in, I speak of the community that I'm from as more so in the African-American community. I grew up in the community in Midtown, 29th in Cleveland, and that is how I was raised, and that is how everyone I know was raised. And we deal with traumas in our households, and then we respond to those traumas, whether that's positively or negatively. And the problem that we're seeing is that what everyone has said today, but also a lack of education and identification. We're not identifying these life situations as trauma. We're not identifying these situations as things that impact not only how we interact with others, but how we think and how we respond and how we solve conflict. All of these things happen and they interact together, and then we see the huge picture. Things become normal. It becomes normal to hear gunshots in the community. It becomes normal to hear police sirens. These are actually traumatic events. It becomes normal to hear yelling and screaming and fighting. This is not normal, but it becomes normal, and it's not identified as a problem.
You were talking about, you know, that this idea of not snitching or that kind of thing is a part of the issue. But you're also talking about that there are sort of deep causes for the kinds of behaviors that contribute to the problem. From a place of empathy and compassion, I mean, what can we understand about why people don't want to share what's going on in their households, why people don't want to reach out for support or name what it is they're going through when they experience trauma?
Some of it is the normalcy. This is normal, so why would I say anything about it? And then some of it is lack of trust. And so when we speak of community helping or how can I help, we have to first be able to identify what's going on. Oftentimes we don't ask the right why question. And when I say why, when we look at kids specifically, we see kids who often have tantrums or acting out. We see anger, we see aggression, and we label them a bad kid. But what we're not asking is why, in the sense of what happened to you? Why are you displaying behaviors as such? Some of it is learned behavior, and some of it is, I don't know any other way to express my emotion. And we're not asking the right questions, and we're not identifying the right behaviors. We often look at the extremes of behaviors as well, but we're not looking at those who are dealing with anxiety or withdrawing or things of that nature. Some who do well, but we're missing the small details.
Toya, what can you say about this? I mean, we're dealing with the psychological piece of this puzzle, but the psychological piece of the puzzle seems very intertwined with systematic problems.
Absolutely. I mean, and this was something that she already pointed out, is that we miss those subtle things. Why is a child acting out? We are, even within schools, we're going to zero tolerance policies, that even elementary schools, zero tolerance, where that young children can be expelled from schools and be labeled as bad children, difficult kids, without ever asking the why question. So
maybe punishing instead of protecting.
And we are very much so on the line of punishment and punitive measures. And we see it in not only in criminal justice, that we don't get the psychological treatment. We are so far removed from rehabilitation because we just want to disassociate ourselves from it's a us versus them. They're problem children, they're problem people. And then we are here and we want separation.
Courtney, I mean, I've been asking this question of people, but just a community member. I mean, I as just a human being in Kansas City. What why questions can I ask? Or, you know, with the psychological piece of it, what is a solution that a member of the community can step in and be a part of?
I would say the first solution would be education. We have to educate ourselves regarding what is going on and what it looks like. We can't do anything until we do that. And once we educate ourselves in that nature, then we can start to develop next steps. How do we step in? What services are needed? Mental health services are something that are not accessed by the community often. And that is a barrier in of itself. So we have to look at that as an issue as well.
Well, our time is up today. I want to thank all of our guests for helping us understand this challenging and complicated issue. Rosalind Temple, Toya Like, Courtney Carr, I really appreciate all of your perspectives.
Thank you.
We spoke earlier in the show with Jackson County Prosecutor Jean Peters Baker, and you can listen back to this discussion at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have a link ready for you later today. Tomorrow, it's a First Friday arts show. We'll dip into a movie about hummus, an annual David Bowie tribute, and the story of an artist who didn't get started until she was 37. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.